thinking that. I'm sure at least one or two of you would have said it later. So I thought I would just get it up and make it clear that's not the case. No, I don't use it. No, you're right, yeah. All right. I think, generally speaking, people that I know are largely amazed at the pace at which things are changing in our society around us today. I mean, it just seems as though people look at it and go like, it seems like all of a sudden overnight, you know, there's a vote on fill in the blank, and now it's a major change on some issue has just taken place. And they're seismic. They're not little things. I mean, they're things that are, I can't figure out what you're saying. Thank you. All right. Every once in a while I'm reading sign language, and my wife's being very helpful, but we don't necessarily have all the signs agreed. So we're going back and forth in this, and you know, you'll think about all the changes that are being made, and it's some of them are seemingly overnight. And I'm reminded of what the writer, the preacher, has said in Ecclesiastes about there being nothing new under the sun. That which has been, chapter 1, verse 9, will be. And that which is done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. Without getting into all of the background or the meaning of the text, I would suggest that when we look at these kinds of changes, what we're seeing is something that's really nothing new under the sun. We could trace it back to the garden. We can go forward from there to the tower and see people who were straining together to be able to rebel against God and to bring God down and under their control to serve them and their needs. And you know what? How did that work out for them? How did that control of God to get what they wanted, did that work out at all? Not at all. And we understand that this is probably going to be the case as we see now. Well, not probably, definitely the case. That ultimately, those who are setting themselves in opposition to the living God are not going to succeed. So we deal with these things as we live in this world, life under the sun, so to speak. And as we do, we've seen in this study so far both what Lewis talked about in his day, going back after the end of World War II, working against an encroaching naturalistic humanism. And then we took a look at the Tower of Babel, which I just mentioned. And now we look at our very own day. And we've started to discuss cultural Marxism or neo-Marxism and the many isms that are all included in this large family. Because so many of the individual things that we see, well, here's this change in society, here's another change in society, here's a third change in society, really all fall under this umbrella of cultural Marxism. In fact, there's a local campaign where someone would actually now, you probably would never have done this 10, 15 years ago, is actually running for an office, you know, in our area as a socialist. And we've seen that downstate as well. And when they say socialist and people talk about Marxist, then people in the paper immediately rush in to say, when I look at, this is not classical Marxism. This is not Marxism like Karl Marx. This is not Marxism with dictators. This is different. This is a different variety. This is a libertarian socialism. This is a libertarian Marxism. And that's one of the titles that's often used for neo-Marxism. And so I'd like us to be able to consider, as we're going to see this again and again, and it's not going to just be philosophers talking in a class to their students. It's not going to merely be people who write these books with no pictures in the middle or graphs at all. They get long, and we go like, I don't know what these people are saying. It's not going to just be those kinds of discussions. But it's actually working itself down into our churches, our elections, our schools. Try and find a place that is unaffected by these influences. And so that being the case, it's important for us to have some idea of what is going on as we look at the world around us. So I want to start off real briefly, as this journalist tried to do at one point, and to draw a distinction, because there is a distinction, and so we should be clear about it, between, let's start off and think of classical Marxism on the one hand, and then later on we'll talk about cultural Marxism, which is what we're looking at in this particular day. Classical Marxism is, of course, many of you have studied. I'm fairly sure the elementary school curricula around here has changed. But, you know, I actually went to Kagabine School across the field for 5th and 6th grade. And I remember in 5th grade reading books like Animal Farm. And then later on in high school reading books like, you know, 1984. And then going on in middle school, that was, and then again in high school, and reading von Mises on economics and other things. Those are not the normal things that are being taught so much today. What are students learning? What are people embracing today? Well, classical Marxism has certainly left its impact, but that's not the strain that's about around us. Let's just start off and say classical Marxism. Marx, just to put this into a time frame, Marx died about 140 years ago. Marx died in 1883. He was the student of somebody who was born about the time of our American Revolution. Carl Friedrich Hegel was his teacher. He was an idealist. He had this idea of religion and the divine. He talked about an absolute spirit, but religion and divine really being what is happening in the lives of individuals, their self-consciousness, and then growing out of their experiences, there was this divine evolution going on. And that this divine evolution, the progress of that, it would be progressive, inexorable. It would not be stopped in any way. So Hegel was the one who was teaching this, and it says Carl Truman, and some of you have been reading his book on this topic. Carl Truman says, Hegel is saying that we know who we are by the relationships that we have to others, our parents, our sibling, our spouses, our children, and so on. So you can understand why accepting someone, because you are having an influence on them, accepting someone as they identify themselves or whatever philosophy that they're advocating has become so important, because it's this social interaction that is making such changes in people's lives and really progressing our understanding of what's true and right and good. And then Marx comes along and he flips this upside down. He goes on, he says that in our place, economy is the determining factor. So he flips it upside down. He says it's not that the ideas form what this world is going to be like. It's not that the ideas are unveiling truth. It's the other way around. The economy, the material part of this world, is influencing who we are. It's developing who we are. It's evolving who we are. And so then he looked at what he considered to be the basic problems that we face. And the basic problem, he says, is looking at the economy and the class structure. So it's economic and it's political. And for Marx, and it was evident through his disciples, Lenin and others, that the result was going to require rapid change and violent change. It required tearing down the power structures that exist, and that was done as a revolution. And then in putting in its place a new power structure. Well, that's the old Marxism. That's the classical Marxism in that sense. That certainly does it no justice. I just was talking to a friend yesterday who's done this massive study back again in Karl Marx and in enormous amounts of books that he's piled up and that he's gone through. And what I just said would be a tragedy compared to all of the research that goes in and flesh that all out. But just as a summary, we started out with Hegel, who looks at the ideal being ideas and relationships. We see Marx, who says, yes, relationships, but relationship with the material, with the means of production, with the fruit of production, with the power in production, with our relationships and our humanity with others in production. That was the original Marxism. And to get control of those things ended up in a violent, as we know, even a bloody revolution. So how is cultural Marxism like or unlike this? Cultural Marxism takes the same discovery of this conflict between social structures, between classes, between groups. And then it takes that narrative and it sort of reads it into every part of life. So you may notice that, you know, rather than bringing about racial reconciliation, the discussions that we seem to have is only exacerbating many of those problems. And that when you take a look at the advances that have been made by other groups that have been groups that have gathered together to try and bring about change, there doesn't seem to, it seems to be, if you talk to the people that I talk to, that progress seems to be going backwards. You know, that people are less and less satisfied with those things. And so in cultural Marxism, we're doing nothing but we're expanding those categories. We're bringing this idea of a conflict, of a class structure, so, or class conflict, so to speak. We're bringing that into almost every area of life. This term, cultural Marxism, was actually coined around from the roots of the First World War. It was coined by a military strategist by the name of William Lind. And William Lind, when he was looking at this idea of class structure that was being brought into all these categories of life, Lind coined the term cultural Marxism to describe this. And it's become so dominant in our educational institutions, in our media, in our governments, and in most social structures in our life, it has become so dominant that one critic asked this question, which is actually the title for our lesson today: are we all cultural Marxists now? And you know, I have to, as I've gone through the and studied some of the things that I've been looking at, I realized that, you know, in my upbringing, through my life, there are places where this has affected my thinking more than I realized, in just various areas. So, is it true that we are all in this milieu? We are all having our thinking marinated by, in whether you're reading the media and you're objecting to it or not. We read these things. We're all being influenced by these terms. It's been quite successful. So, when cultural Marxists talk about it, that, you know, it doesn't sound popular, right? Well, see, you know, I want to run for office because I'm a cultural Marxist and I want to control the avenues of power. Probably not going to get a lot of votes. So how do we talk about it? I want to run for office. I'm a socialist. I want to run for office because I want people to be liberated. People are oppressed, and they need to be liberated. They need to have freedom. They need those opportunities. Those are the words that are used today to describe cultural Marxism. Marsus was from the Frankfurt School, and he put it this way: traditional societies promote, and I always kind of love this, a repressive tolerance because they do not deal with latent inequalities of humans. You know, there are latent inequalities of humans. They're just, you know, if you were born and your parents decided that they didn't have much money, but they were going to sacrifice everything they had so you could have a good education, and somebody else didn't have that same upbringing, you could call that a latent inequality. You know, you probably don't hear people talking about latent inequalities much, right? Yeah, it's not a term that we hear. What about white privilege? Have you heard that term? What is that a discussion of? Latent inequalities. That's the thrust of what's going on. Here we're looking at, and by the way, that statement comes from somebody long, long, long ago. This is not somebody out on the current edge of things trying to bring about. Here we're looking at the idea that society, if it's going to do what the cultural Marxists think it should do, society is to guarantee an equality of outcome. So that's very different from traditional tolerance, traditional equality. You know, we've always talked about equality in our country. What does that mean? Well, how's about equal access to things? How's about equal being given equal justice under the law, and those kinds of things, an equal process that's fair and just along the way. That's what we talk about. What's being spoken of here is if at the end of the day there's a difference in outcome, then that has to be by some injustice and inequality. And if it's by somebody who's ever been in power, then they must be pride-free from that latent inequality. Well, okay. How is this going to happen? How is this going to take place? And probably the greatest distinction, of course, between classical Marxism and cultural Marxism is how will this be brought to effect? And the cultural Marxist approach in how to bring this about is certainly different from what we've seen before. In this current revolution, cultural Marxism are all about, liberating humanity from social institutions and conditions. What kinds of things do we need to liberate people from? The family, the church, and businesses, and views and habits and authorities and social institutions and conditions that prevent individual liberty, identity, self-identity, and self-desire and aspirations from being anything that we want to be. Social institutions certainly include things like the police, the government, etc. So if this is the goal, we need to liberate people from all these nasty institutions like the church, like family, etc., then how are we going to bring that about? So in the current revolution that we see, we go back to Antonio Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci, the Italian neo-Marxist, coined the term neo-Marxism, brought about great change in the thrust. He spoke about hegemony. Hegemony, just from the Greek, that means ruler. But hegemony, the definition that he would give would be this. It's the dominant class exerts influence over people through non-coercive means, such as media, marketing, and education. In our world today, their point would be that it's not as though you need to have a military force enforcing all the laws, but through media, through marketing, through education, you do control what people think. And by the way, that's not unfair. I mean, one of the main advances of Dewey in education was to try and move education from giving basic skills like reading, writing, and arithmetic. But as the country was becoming a melting pot of people from various cultures, it was stated publicly that the educational system would be used to help mold people into what it would mean to be a good citizen. Unfortunately, what Dewey's view of what it meant to be a good citizen and what most of us might have as a view of what it means to be a good citizen are radically different. But the educational system has become very effective at doing just that. Well, what happens if you get control of these elements? If you can get control of the media, if you can get control of marketing, if you can get control of education, what is it that you want to do with that? And I would suggest that one of the things that we would do with that, or he would suggest, I should say, really, is to develop what might become power structures. I don't know if I have that up here. Let me see. Yeah, plausibility structures. That sounds like a funny thing. We don't want to talk about it. But, you know, as Christians, we talk about that. We talk about it under a different term. How many of you have heard the term apologetics? Okay. How many of you have studied apologetics in any way, shape, or form? What is the goal of apologetics? And, you know, when you start out and you're giving some proof to somebody why they ought to believe in God, are you actually giving a gospel evangelistic presentation? To some extent? What apologetics hopefully does is to prove that the God of Scripture is plausible. That it makes sense to believe that there is a living God. That it makes sense to believe that there's a sovereign God. That it makes sense to believe there's a creator. That it makes sense to believe there's one who governs. And then from that, the gospel is built on top of that. Now, there's different ways to do apologetics, right? There's presuppositional ways, there's evidential ways, whatever. But all of that is to tear down this mindset that people have that it's foolish to think about God. To think that someone like this could exist. And to lay out that platform upon which the gospel then is built. I mean, in its clearest sense, in actual practice, the one moves from the other almost seamlessly, but that's the thrust of it. Plausibility structures, that's a secular way of describing secular apologetics. The goal of the movement today is to demonstrate that secularism, a world without God, secularism is plausible. The goal is to make people think that certain values, not necessarily Christian values, certain values, certain practices are normal. and that other values and practices are aberrant or perverted. And that's what we see going on that strikes people so radically today, or so much today, is because in so many areas, what once was unthinkable, I'm going to use that term, unthinkable, is now out, proud, and normal. And what was once front and center normative across the boards in culture is now considered unthinkable and dangerous. So without having to give an entire lecture on this, that's what we're talking about. Here's the main goal. The main goal is to present, and by working it into the media, into the messages, educational system, into churches that have been very effective at this, to work it into those avenues, they begin to change the thinking of people so that they no longer consider what we would think is right, good, and true to be acceptable. You could take a look at that. I remember being in Albany as we dealt with the issues of same-sex marriage in New York State, and prior to that time, we were watching a movement in the media from the time I got out of seminary. I'll just give you one example. When I was still in seminary in my last years, I remember that ABC was going to put on a comedy, and in that comedy there was going to be a homosexual man who kind of became like an uncle for a single mother and her kids, and was it Tony Randall or somebody who was going to play in it. And there was such a hue and outcry across the nation. I'm not talking just churches. Across the nation. That the show was canceled before it ever aired its pilot. Is that how it works today? No. No. I mean, it's every aspect of society, comic books for kids, everything you're seeing now, we got to change out the roles of individuals in them to create this plausibility structure. And I watched it in people's lives who at one point would have been absolutely repulsed or angry or opposed, and then they become more, okay, I don't know, and then more accepting, and then, oh yes, we have this has to be part of our society. That's the process that's been going on for years and years and years. And so really we're coming to think about the power of ideas. As we look at this approach in this current revolution that's around us, there is an emphasis on ideas that shape the economy, not the other way around. Classical Marxism, economy shapes everything else. Cultural Marxism, ideas shape the economy. They shape what goes on about us. And so change comes not from a violent, sudden, bloody revolution. Change comes through a very slow, methodical, patient process by infiltrating institutions like churches and others. Let me put some of this up here. Here we go. Infiltrating institutions like churches and schools and institutions of society like the media and civil institutions like police and courts and the civil courts. Gramsci called this process becoming the state. That was this is what he called it. The Italian neo-Marxists called that becoming the state, subverting society by changing the state virtually from within. From within. And so we've been watching that going on easily since the late 40s and 50s in our nation. So for over the last 70 years, this has been going on in our land and very effective in what it's doing, so much so that the culture of our nation, which was once rooted in Judeo-Christian ethics, that worldview, that's giving way, and now a secular worldview is dominant in our nation. And as cultural Marxism and its perspectives becomes more plausible to a greater number of people, Christianity becomes less plausible to a greater number of people. And when I say less plausible, what I mean, how does that affect For example, an evangelistic approach, when you talk with somebody, well, here's what it is. I mean, like, it's not something to argue about. You believe in God, fine. If you want to believe that personally, okay. If you want to, like, do that in the walls of your church, okay. But quite honestly, I don't even need to consider it. It is implausible to me that this could ever be true. So I don't want to argue about it. I don't even need to hear about it. I don't need to give it any serious thought. For example, I don't know your personal convictions on this area, but even though I recommended the Paralanda Trilogy to read, if you were to come up and tell me that you seriously believe that Martians are living here on Earth and have taken over the government and all the people that you know who disagree with you, I probably would not give that any serious consideration. You know, I got a number of things to study. That's not going on my top list. Just telling you. And that's how people approach things of God today, which is markedly different from the way people in the West approach the things of God many, many years ago. That's why it's important. Now, by the way, since people left the garden, since they were dispersed from the Tower of Babel, I'm not going to suggest that anybody was totally ready to sit down and embrace the living God. You know, that was their default setting. Rebellion against God had been the default setting for millennia, but at least there was an understanding that there is some creature greater than us with whom we have to do. And that seems to have become something that we're missing more and more. Well, as we move towards this, sorry, should I go on? Let me see, I had all this stuff up there. I'm not doing very well this morning. I apologize. Let's talk about tolerance. Don't you love to hear about tolerance today? It's always around us, right? So positive tolerance. Here's the one of the first things. Positive tolerance has to happen first in this quiet revolution. Positive tolerance is the idea that all the people on our side, you know, if we're trying to take over the nation, we need to be nice to one another. It's kind of like the Republicans were for a while. You know, like, you don't attack Republicans, okay? And it's like, that's just kind of the ground rule they had. That's gone. Well, on the left, it was, we don't attack each other. And quite honestly, when you look at the goals of some of the groups that have banded together over the years, they're not the same at all. But we're just going to let it go. Because we're all together fighting for all of us and what we want. So that's the first area of tolerance. There needs to be a positive tolerance for those of us who were the, quote, oppressed, so to speak. And now, there needs to be zero tolerance for anyone who's in opposition. People, I think, today have branded that the cancel culture. But as we look at our society today, there is the on the one side, those who are pushing forward for a cultural Marxism, there is an emphasis on being a victim. It's sort of like 21st century humility. I'm a victim. This is what I've suffered. This is why you have to be nice to me. This is why I deserve to be given reparations and or go fill in the blank, however you want to call it. More access, whatever. There's this ever-broadening coalition of victim groups, racial, ethnic, religious, sexual, gender orientations, disabilities, immigrants, all trying to come under this umbrella of an oppressed group that must therefore be given deference and more than what we would talk about in a biblical sense, equal justice under the law. And then the last thing, as we'll finish this section this morning and then we'll go on, but the last thing here is to notice that for the cultural Marxists, this is a patient program. Unfortunately, I think when people that I see often standing up for righteousness do that for like one election cycle or one president or one whatever, and then they get tired or go crazy. I mean, it's just like, okay, I'm done. The people who are working towards these things have been at work for 70 years or more. It has been a consistent, like a drip in water. you know, just like coming through the roof and doing damage down below. And it's constant, constant, constant. I would just point out when we think about this, here we go, that this process in their own internal writings is often described as capturing the commanding heights of culture. That's a noble goal. And if you're sitting on the outside and you're starting this, capturing the commanding heights of culture is not going to happen overnight. So you know you're in for the long haul as you deal with it. But also, and it was a student group in England about in the 70s, I think, put it this way. They talked about being on a long march through the institutions. And that's exactly what we have seen taking place. This long march through the institutions. You had a lot of workers' groups that were already on board with classical Marxism. Now you start off and add to that these groups that are infiltrating. Where do we see it almost first? In the educational institutions, in higher education. And let's command that and take it down from there. Where do we see it again? In the media. I mean, the messages for social change are always, before legislation ever shows up, it's always previewed in the media. And the media is used to make things acceptable to the people at large before anything else takes place. You know, and then it moves on from there. By the way, since at least the 50s, churches have been of a certain variety. Those who are not interested in the Word of God, the testimony of Jesus Christ, have been committed to these principles. And people have asked me, I don't know how many times, it's not like I've crawled in anybody's heads, but why, if you don't believe there's a God, if you don't believe Christ rose from the dead, if you don't believe the Bible is God's word, and I've been in ordination exams in Presbyterian Western New York where people denied all those things. If you don't believe those kinds of things, why do you want to be a minister? And I've said since I started, I said, because the pulpit, even though people aren't going to church as much as they used to, the pulpit is a place that can bring about great social change. And people who want to change society don't care about God. That doesn't matter. They don't want to. They want to change society. They want to stay in the pulpits. And so we're watching this slow progress. We'll continue on taking a look at this particular topic, Lord willing, next week, and as we continue to unpack what's happening in the world about us, to understand it, and then also to respond to it. Thank you.